in a sentence, prayer, what it is. It says, realizing that we are conditioned by the church into a mode of prayer which now seems quite inadequate and unreal, what form should prayer take? Should it be a regular, say daily, self-conscious reflexiveness before God, and a declaration and inquiring into one's motives for action? From thought, following on from prayer, on these lines comes the realization that motives and actions continually taking place through the day, and therefore through life, must necessarily mean that life becomes a dedicated and continual prayer. And prayer as a separate, quiet time must surely be needed for self-reflection. Is this prayer? Prayer has occurred a lot of times and not defined. We'll give a definition of prayer according to the phonetic value of the word itself. We take out the consonants, P-R-Y-R, and we give the meaning to them. P-R means point differentiations, to see the differences in any point, whatever. Y means affirmation, and R again means differentiation. So prayer, analyzed in its consonants, means that in every point of experience we should differentiate the experience and see precisely what constitutes it, see all the separate elements in the experience. And then when we've seen them, we must affirm these differences. We must accept the differences that we see. We mustn't repel some of them as unpleasant. We mustn't prefer certain elements of the experience. We must affirm the whole of the experience. I'll repeat this definition. In any point of experience, we must see the constituent elements which constitute the differences which appear on analysis of the event. And when we've seen all the contained differences in the experience, we must affirm these differences. We must not find some of them unpleasant, repress them, and deny their existence. We must not select the pleasant bits and pretend they are the only elements present. We must see all the elements that are present and affirm their existence. And if we do this continuously, remembering the definition in the Bhagavad Gita of prayer, prayer is continual remembrance. If we continually remember, that is, make again a member of consciousness, the elements of experience, then we are praying continuously. If we don't do this, we are only dealing with a part of reality. We are being partial. When a man is being partial to a cake, or partial to jam, or partial to a girl, or partial to a piece of furniture, in effect it means that he's treating himself as less than the total situation and is identifying with a single element in the situation, a part of the situation, and in so doing he's being determined by the part instead of by the whole situation. And he expresses this by saying he's been partial to jam or cake or whatever it is. Now in true prayer there is no partiality. Just as with God, God is no respecter of persons, and he has no partiality, because if he is to retain control of his universe, he cannot afford to be partial. He must be impartial. He must keep the whole of phenomena before him, the whole of form, the whole of motive, feeling, whatever there is, he must hold it all simultaneously in order to see the significant relationships of all the constituents of the universe. And it is this ability to see the constituent elements in a situation without eliminating any because they are unpleasant, and without selecting some special one because they're pleasing, to affirm the whole situation with all its constituent elements consciously is prayer. If you affirm the whole, you will adjust to the whole. If you affirm only the part, you will adjust only to the part. And then that which you happen to adjust it to will be outside your control. Prayer, then, in effect, is a means of coming more and more into contact with reality. You see the whole situation, all the elements in it, and you try to make yourself sharply conscious of all the constituent elements, and you affirm that their differences are significant and valuable to you, and in no sense do you repress any of them. In no sense do you force them out of consciousness because of their unpleasantness. This guarantees that your consciousness will always be a whole from moment to moment. It also guarantees, if you are doing it, that you will be alert. Alert means all work. A-L is an eluded L there, and ert is the same as ert, work. Alert means all work. And that means that you are conscious of all the elements in the experience. The moment you let some of the elements in the experience lapse, you're no longer alert. You're only partially hurt, not all hurt. I think that will do for this definition of prayer, and it comes then to the question. Prayer as a separate quiet time, is this needed for self-reflection? And the answer is, if you are applying the definition of prayer as continual remembrance and prayer as the differentiation of the constituent elements in the experience and their affirmation, if you are doing this continuously through the day, it follows, unless you've got a 24-hour job, that some parts of the day will be relatively quiet, and in these quiet times you can carry on praying. Let us say you can practice your reflexive self-consciousness in the quietness. But it is essential that you manage to do this same thing in the midst of noise, in the midst of your daily work. Because if you only pray when it is quiet, when the external stimulus situation is not pressing you too much, then you will only be equipped to deal with quiet situations. But one thing you can do in the quiet time, and that is rehearse potential difficult times, hypothetical situations that might stress you should be rehearsed during the quiet times. And again, you should define for yourself experiences which you might undergo, and you should state to yourself all the constituent elements of these experiences and the correct reply which you should give as an integrated, reflexively self-conscious person. If in the quiet times you actually work in this way, you will set up in yourself an awareness of many elements which would otherwise be unconscious, and then when the situation as defined arises, you are already alert. You've done all the work necessary to deal with the situation. Remember what we said before about Napoleon, when he was asked by one of his officers, how is it that you react so adequately in all these new situations, military strategic situations? And Napoleon replied, they are not new to me. He had rehearsed all possible contingencies, and so he had worked throughout the whole situation. Therefore he was alert. The more you do this and rehearse adequate reactions in stimulus situations, the more you will be ready, you will be quick. In Christ's terms, quick means the same thing as mercurial. Remember that mercury, quick silver, and silver is the metal of the mind. Quicksilver is the symbol of the quick mind. Christ defines human beings as of two kinds, the quick and the dead. The quick are the quicksilver, and you know quicksilver, if you hit it, will roll about, break into little balls, it will analyze itself, and run about very rapidly. If you have a quick mind, you can do the same. You can strike on the situation, shatter it into millions of little balls, and see the constituents of the situation, just as it were a ball of mercury. If you are dead, it simply means that your reactions have been conditioned, like Pavlov's dogs were conditioned, by presentation of stimuli, painful or pleasant, and these, engrammed in your memory, are reacting for you. so that in effect you never face the present, because you are being dictated to by the past stimulus situation. So to become quick in Christ's sense, to become mercurial, to become ready, is to increase the speed with which one becomes aware of all the constituent elements in the conversation, in the experience that you have. To help do this, if you remember that you're a three-part being, human relations are more important for you than any others, and therefore you are in relation with a being or beings that have three parts, and therefore every being with whom you relate yourself must have thoughts, feelings and urges or motives, and these three will be operating simultaneously on their various levels. So that if when you are talking to a person and you are merely following the formal rational side of their argument without trying to discover how they feel about the argument and to discover their underlying motive or the urge driving them to where they want to be, then you're only doing one third of the work. So when you're discussing with any people at all about anything, don't only follow the rational line of the argument, try to see where they like and dislike particular ideas presented, and try to discover what their motive is, why they are pushing in this direction rather than that. Now if you do these three things simultaneously, follow the line of the argument formally, rationally, and at the same time notice whether they like or dislike the particular idea being presented at the moment, and simultaneously you are trying to discover the urge direction, which is the motive, what the motive that keeps the whole thing going. It has an aim, it is trying to get from A to X. You have to discover X by seeing the continuous trend in the affective life, the liking and disliking, which itself is the ground of this motive. So you must do these three things simultaneously in order to become quick. The person that only listens to the rational side of an argument without discovering the underlying motive can easily be fooled. In fact, a politician is there to present you with rational arguments without ever displaying his real motive in presenting them. So if you only follow the argument, you're doing one third of prayer. Hardly one third, really. If you follow whether he likes it or dislikes it and forget the argument, again you're not doing the full job. If you try to discover his motive and ignore his argument and whether he likes it or not, you will fail. If you do these three things simultaneously and then see the relation between them, that is the fourth thing. That's why I said it wasn't really a third when you're merely following the rational argument. If you think that coordination is an extra special act where you tie these three things together and call that the fourth thing, then thinking is only a quarter. And is that sufficient for the prayer?
Are you working on three levels if you're listening to the sound shifts in a person's voice, where you get the lower tone, feeling tone? You do get those shifts, don't you?
You may be, but in order to make sure that you were, you would have to know not only that there were sound shifts occurring and different tone modes of production, whether the voice closed and became nasal at a certain point, which happens spontaneously when somebody disagrees with you. The nose wrinkles, the tone becomes nasal for a second. Or, on the other hand, if the appetite opens, you'll hear the throat open and the vowel will move towards O-O. But when you're listening to those, you could easily fall into simply noting the changes of tone without noticing also simultaneously the affective, the liking, disliking, and the conative or urge value of the same thing. You have to do everything at once, and in order to do it you have to be quick.
I mean there are several things happening when you're talking to people. They can start at certain points to start fidgeting and things like that, and they are indicative of some shift, aren't they?
They may be, but you might come up against a golden mile who would fidget on purpose to distract you. You see, you have to do these things simultaneously Otherwise you can be deceived. So even if somebody does fidget, your ability to interpret the fidget means that you are aware of his fundamental motive, his urge, of the liking, disliking in him, and of the rational form of his argument, and you are coordinating these three at once. Because the fidget might not be a fidget, he might be just pretending. And only your sensitivity to his feeling and motive can tell you whether he's pretending. So no partial activity, no partial analysis can be an effective substitute for this total threefold awareness and the coordination of it. Now, I did say something last week about reading slowly and finding out the meaning of the words used. So I've brought a translation of the Signatura Rerum of Jakob Werner here. I thought we'd start with chapter 1 here and just see if we can manage to get through perhaps the first paragraph. Now it says here, all whatever is spoken, written, or taught of God without the knowledge of the signature is dumb and void of understanding. Now it says here, all, and we simply have to analyze each word if really to understand what we're talking about. It's easy to dash through this thing, and I have a friend who has a copy of this book, which they first started reading in 1927, and 2 years ago this friend discovered it wouldn't be a bad idea to read chapter 1 because it had been read too rapidly and the full significance of this opening statement had been missed. But it is the key to the whole book. It says all means that our prana energy and the L function, the labouring and linking, tying together. All whatever means that the absolute energy is working in a peculiar way and producing whatnesses. Now a whatness is something like scholastic quiddity that is simply a content of consciousness. Because of the T in it, you know that it's a finite content of consciousness. So if we say all whatever, the all is the binding concept of the absolute energy, and the whatever inside it is referring to the finites which are embraced by the line signified by this L. All whatever means that there is nothing whatever that could be considered to be excluded from this statement. It's therefore an absolute statement. It is not just some things, but all things whatever that are being considered. So we're not allowed to say in a few moments, does it apply to dogs too? This kind of thing is said, and it is unconsciously assumed. All whatever is spoken, you know, speaking means uttering sounds, and these sounds, in order to be words, have to have intended reference value. They have to point towards some aspects of experience. So spoken means that sound is given out and that the sound is intended to refer to some elements of experience. Written means, of course, making marks on paper to represent the sounds of speech. Taught is a funny word because it's made of the word ought, which is anything whatever, and is the opposite of not, which is not ought. And it's from a primary root, a power root, represented by the GH, established on the T itself being the cross. And the T at the beginning means, again, that you're going to fix this path. So, just as in the word teach, it is to each. Let us say all teaching is a stimulus to individuals. So, taught implies that an ought or power energy has been fixed on something. And when you fix an energy in a being, the being is said to be taught. And it is also related to that tautness that corresponds with tension. And therefore to teach to each, to give an individual stress in the receiving individual, is to have taught him and to have produced a tautness in relation to that concept, a tension. Mm-hmm. It is physiologically a physical tension. Psychologically, it is an act of attention. But the tension at the physical level is the same as tension appearing at the psychological level as the mental act of attention. So a person who has been taught has actually been set in a state of tension about the subject matter which has been taught. So the teaching actually selects from the sum total possibilities of form some forms and gives them an extra tension. This tension makes them operate in the substance of the taught person more rapidly, more efficiently than the untaught, the unstressed. So this teaching makes readiness to react to given forms. All whatever is spoken, written or taught of God, now he says of God, he hasn't defined God here yet. Later on in the book he will define God. When we look at the word itself, we see that it's made up of the elements of earth, again, of a space or zone, and of D, which means analysis. It is a substantial space divided. So it implies, when we analyse the word substance and reduce substance to power, that this God to which Verma is referring is the absolute power of the universe, which differentiates all the separate events of the universe within itself. All whatever is spoken, written or taught of God without the knowledge of the signature is dumb and void of understanding. Now, knowledge is made of this verb to know, and this means to lock now, immediately. Whatever is in consciousness now held, and it is held reflexively so that you know that you know, is said to be knowledge. There is a ledge in it because in effect you have abstracted from the total background of formal possibilities some which you have brought into a high state of tension, and this tension constitutes the nowness of the form perceived. And because in drawing a now finitely you have made an edge, and this edge itself is a danger, because when you define the thing you have excluded some things as well as including the things talked about. So in knowledge you're concerned with the present moment's consciousness content. Now signature is the trickiest word to deal with, and if it is not understood then nothing whatever can be understood in the works of this man. Signature is made of the nature of sig. Sig, as in the Greek sigma, which is a special letter, signifies spirit into earth. S-I-G, the sig. The nature of sig. If we see that when power behaves in a formal manner, then the mode of its behavior is evidence of the power so behaving. The power is characterized by its mode of action. When we look at a gross material thing, say like coal in a grate, which is made of a word to coalesce, to come together, to tie it up, we see energy brought down into the gross world, and we know that if we treat it in a certain way, apply heat and so on, it will then start to go through various processes and it will give forth the original light and heat which was previously involved in the coal. The sunlight shone on primeval forests. Those forests had fallen down, decayed, been compressed or coalesced, and constitute coal. If we look at coal and examine coal chemically, and then put coal empirically through various experiments, we discover that coal is compacted light and heat from the sun. Now, coal, therefore, is the gross material evidence of the possibility of the compacting of light and heat at the gross level. And this is the nature of Sig as Kol. Sig is this primary spirit put into a point and made gross, so that every gross body, if examined and tested under various conditions, will reveal that it has energies in itself, that it is constituted by these energies, and that the energies constituted in it evidence their presence by the internal form or structural geometry of the gross matter under consideration. Sig then means precisely this, that the spirit or primary energy has involved itself in the gross material level, and that the gross material will give you geometrical evidence of the kind of spirit in its characteristic form. Nature is now Tura, and Na is an old form of a serpent going along, and Tura is the same as the rota, or cyclic process of events. So Na Tura means the motions, like those of a serpent, and the cyclic principles conditioning these motives. So signature means the law of the motions which are evidence in a gross material body, and compacted in this way prove that certain energies, spirit, are so involved. So all that is taught of God without knowledge of the signature is dumb and void of understanding. Dumb means that it can't really speak at all, and it has no understanding. Christ says the same thing when he says the letter kills, the spirit quickens. He meant to say that the letter, the visible letter, if you are determined by it, can totally mislead you, because the form of the letter as written is not identical with the sound as heard. And when the sound has external reference value, it is pointing you really in the wrong direction if you think that the sound derives from the material body. The material bodies, the gross material bodies, are precipitants of the Logos. And the Logos is the formative, today we say ultrasonic, power. In other words, sound and form are identical at the top level. Sound and form precipitate the gross material, so that when we look at a material object, we should try to think back towards the geometrical formative forces that precipitated themselves into that gross level. All whatever is spoken, written, or taught of God without the knowledge of the signature is dumb and void of understanding. Understanding is getting underneath the diverse phenomenal world. If we look at the crest of waves on the sea, and we fascinate ourselves by identifying with particular wave crests, we can forget totally that these wave crests are simply modal behaviours of the sea. If we remember the sea, and we understand the nature of the sea, its viscosity, and the way it responds to the pressure of the wind, and we see that these waves arise from the nature of the sea, and the nature of the impelling force, then we are understanding it. Whereas if we merely see the individual wave forms, and forget that they are simply the modal operations of the sea, then we have no understanding. In the same way, if we try to watch the behaviour of a human being and have no control concept, that first of all, as a finite, he's made of protoplasm, which is irritable, which responds to stimuli according to its capacity to assimilate them, and some stimuli cause pain, that is, they repel the protoplasm, and some cause pleasure, that is, they are easily assimilable. If we forget these things, then we haven't got much understanding. if we think when we see Khrushchev browbeating an unfortunate American gentleman, that there is anything underneath it at all, other than the will of one man to keep to his point and get on with his own purpose, then we have no understanding. If we are fooled by the display of superficial arguments on the top, and we forget that he is a will going in a definite direction, and that all the arguments on the top are as superficial as the foam that gets on the sea. If we forget those things, we have no understanding. Understanding means get underneath it, stand underneath, get on the very, very rock bottom foundation, see what goes on down there. And then he says why this is so. Without knowledge of the signature, everything is dumb. It can't tell you what it should tell you, void of understanding. For it proceeds only from an historical conjecture. Now, historical conjecture, by this he means from events of the past. And these events are thrown together. Conjecture is throwing together. The previous history of man has thrown men together in cities and other places, chiefly in cities, and in their being thrown together through mutual stimulation, they have been provoked to speak, and their speakings added up constitute historical conjectures. Now they have been thrown up in the contingent relationship, and as we've seen before, by drawing finite circles external to each other and touching, no contingent relationship can tell you the essential quality inside a being. Contingent stimulation is external. So historical conjecture is external, because it simply means the process of throwing men together in closed situations. Their mutual stimulation gives rise to conjectures. These conjectures, in their totality of the past up to now, are called historical. And therefore they can have no value at all, except to a person who understands signature. To understand signature is to understand how forces of spirit internally working precipitate gross material objects. But in a historical contingent relation, these gross material objects impinge against each other. They knock superficially and externally. And in their being thrown together, they produce peculiar sounds. And these peculiar sounds then constitute the babble language, or confused language, of men in contingent relation. And this language of babble cannot tell you anything at all at the contingent level of the nature of spirit. It proceeds only from an historical conjecture from the mouth of another. He expresses it again in an exterior manner, from the mouth of another being. Now, if it comes from inside myself, and truly comes from inside myself, and is not simply memory of an external stimulus situation, then I am growing in self-knowledge. And if the thing comes from outside, from a contingent stimulus, then if I externalize my attention onto it, it cannot tell me anything at all about myself. So not to understand the nature of signature is to be, in fact, conditioned by the mouthings of men thrown together in groups, where one mouth speaks to another through contingent stimulation. And in such, in historical conjecture and from the mouth of another, the spirit without knowledge is dumb. It cannot speak. It has no formal way of expressing itself. If the terms are not correct, if the terms you get refer only to contingent relation, which means practically the whole of empirical scientific terms, by their very nature they cannot tell us anything at all about the inner spirit which actually creates those forms. Then he says, but if the spirit opens to him the signature, then he understands the speech of another. And we're supposed to be doing this one word at a time, and we're not doing it at the moment. We because we are going back to explain a word in terms of some other words. Gradually, by extra hard work, we can go back to define even a word like the indefinite article. We can see what makes it indefinite. We can see why in the definite article Z there is a T, why in the indefinite article we have simply A, the symbol of the absolute. Meanwhile, we're doing as much work as we can do within the available time, defining our chief terms. If the spirit opens to him the signature, that spirit itself is the original, absolute, sentient power, which by its very nature is motion, and by its nature as motion is essentially formative, and therefore throughout its infinity is continuously formulating. And this formulating process is not productive of static end results, so that it is not formulated, it is formulating. We can think about nature as formulated only if we close our mind to the dynamic facts. If I ignore the process is taking place in this chair, I can pretend that the chair is static. If I get an electron microscope and examine the chair with it, I will discover that it's highly dynamic. So if I believe in anything static in the world, it can only be by finiting my attention in such a way that I can ignore the constituent motions of things. If the spirit opens to him the signature, then he understands the speech of another. Now this is the exercise that Bert was talking about. If we go internally to spirit, and we then listen to another person speaking with full consciousness, we can hear in the modulations of the voice, in the mode of production of the vowels, of the consonants, and so on, what is the reason of that person, whether he likes it or not, and what his primary urge is pushing towards. So that if we have this spirit, this inner consciousness, well developed, then the speech of another person can be understood by it. And further, he understands how the spirit has manifested and revealed itself out of the essence through the principle in the sound with the voice. He says how the spirit is manifested, that means made fast the form in order to be counted, and revealed, and reveal here is a double word because it means not only show you the significance of, but it also means to cover up again. And the reason for this is because form is essentially a cover on the power, by and of the power constituting that form. So if we look at the form of this book, we see that approximately it's like, when closed, a box. That is its external form. We open it and we find it has pages. We look on the pages and we find the form of ink. Now all these forms are really a covering up of the power in peculiar ways. We are not seeing the power as power, we are seeing the power as form. And therefore, no man has seen the Father, the Son declares him. Nobody could possibly see the absolute power which has created all things, because by definition the absolute power is not finite. Nevertheless, the Son, that is this same power incarnate as the Son of God, can declare it. No man has seen the Father, the Son declares it. This means that when you become consciously aware of this inner process of spirit, of consciousness, inside yourself, at that moment, then the Father, the generative power, is incarnate in you consciously. And you then are one mind with the Son. You then have at that moment the mind of Christ. That is to say, if you contemplate the whole of cosmic being simultaneously, which requires a certain amount of energy. At the moment you succeed in doing so, you have participated in the mind of Christ. That is, you have participated in cosmic mind. And when we say you have participated, we are doing a little dialectical trick. If you've only participated, you're only a part of it. But that refers to your physical body, the reference point from which you started to do the exercise. So the participation, then, means that you have started with a finite body as reference. Then you've extended your consciousness beyond the parts in order to become one with the cosmic mind. And yet you retain a memory of the body from which you started. When you refer to the body from which you started, and from that back to the cosmic, then you say you are participating. And if you forget the body from which you started, then you say you are identifying with the cosmic mind. So whether you are participating or actually identifying with the universal depends entirely on whether you retain or lose the memory of the individual organism from which you started your exercise. Reveal itself out of the essence through the principle. He's saying that essence is behind principle. Now this principle, prince means first. First means head of a series. And behind the series is that which continuously supports all the elements of the series, but itself is never expressed in the elements of the series. So if we take the saw and the teeth, if you look at the teeth, they are presented serially, but they're all steel, and on the back of the saw there's a smooth line. And the back of the saw we could call the essence, where the smooth line is. And as we're coming up towards the teeth, we are passing through, from the essence, through the principle of differentiation, into segregation as teeth. So we can give rise to the idea of separateness without any actual severance of the metal by simply serrating the edge. So out of the essence, from that which is absolutely non-different, through the principle, which is the rational first or head of a series, in the sound with the voice. Sound is form. You may remember in Freud's Psychopathology of Everyday Life how he described the interesting fact that he noticed of slips, mental slips, little accidents, slips of the tongue occur. When you hear these, they are significant. Like a man that said, you are, I am, I believe you are, growed, I think it was. You have growed, sir. And he inserted another letter into this by mistake, wrote it on top of one of the constituent letters, and changed the word into another one, which actually meant the exact opposite of what he wrote. And this was a slip. They occur on the pen and they occur in speech. If you are very alert, you can hear the word that the man really meant trying to express itself over the thing he's trying to cover it with. And this again is through the sound in the voice. You can hear, through the principle, the essence of his meaning. So there is an essence. This essence is moving into principles, differentiating as prime forms or heads of series and derivative forms, and then appearing as separate sounds and manifesting in the human voice. So changes of tone, changes of pronunciation, of vowels, of consonants, are all indicative. He says, for though I seem unto speak, teach, preach, and write of God, and though I hear and read the same, yet this is not sufficient for me to understand him. So you see that he says speaking and teaching and preaching and writing itself is not sufficient to make any man understand. But if his sound and spirit, out of his signature, that's his essential precipitated character, and similitude enter into my own similitude, he's saying that where two substances have something similar, then communication is possible. And if he imprint his similitude into mine, then I may understand him, really and fundamentally, be it neither spoken nor written, if he has the hammer that can strike my bell. This means that all works written, all works spoken, all preachings, all teachings are useless unless, now if you take again the threefold man, you can draw the wave crest in his head, and you can draw a straight line at the bottom, and somewhere between that straight line, corresponding with the unmodified basic urge of being, somewhere between that baseline and the breaking lines of the foam on the wave crest, there is a feeling line where the water is just moving without breaking into wave forms. So we get a basic line, a continuum, a simple drive of the fundamental primitive urge to be, and right at the top they analyze broken wave top and the little separated balls of water, the froth on the top, and in the mid regions an undulating motion that participates in something of the nature of the top and of the bottom, and thus mediates between the two. This is why the mid regions are said to be most important, why in fact the control of breath and the awareness of your own breathing rate is very important to understand how you're orientated towards the ideas presented in your mind and how they act as inhibiting factors on your primary drive. We've gone very quickly actually through the first paragraph there. He does say that unless we understand the nature of seeing, we cannot communicate, and that communication is only possible providing we have similar substances and similar forms. If we haven't got this, we're wasting our time. So if we get a man who speaks only Kiswahili, and we take him to a gentleman who speaks only English, and allow them to debate philosophically at some point, they will get nowhere, because they have no similitude in the organ of communication in their language. So obviously, if we wish to communicate, one of the first things we've got to do is find these similitudes. We have some awareness of these similitudes the moment we know that all human beings think, feel, and have urges, and we should then divide our vocabulary up into three categories of words, at least: the words that deal with purely rational propositions, the words that deal with liking and disliking, and the words that deal with prime urges. If we do this consciously, then we can really begin to communicate with each other. He then said, by this we know that all human properties proceed from one. How do we know this? Because he said that only by similitude can communication occur. And the sim in similitude means seed. So he draws from it, by this we know that all human properties proceed from one, that they all have but one only root and mother. By mother he means substance. Otherwise one man could not understand another in the sound, for with the sound or speech the form notes and imprints itself into the similitude of another. He says that the mere fact that we can communicate at all is a proof of our similitude, and therefore of our ultimate unity of substance. So that the very thing that apparently guarantees our difference, namely a jolly good argument and discussion, a fight, virtually, is by the mere fact of communication a guarantee that there's really no ground of argument. And again, this is a dialectical fact. If the person argues with you, it is a relation. If it is a relation, there is a common factor, a similar substance, and therefore any statement about an absolute difference between the communicants and the argument is rendered false by the existence of the argument. He says, a like tone or sound catches and moves another, and in the sound the spirit imprints its own similitude, which it has conceived in the essence and brought to form in the principle. A like tone or sound catches and moves another. Now, when you're studying logic, normally, you take the definition of your words and you proceed, apparently, from the defined term through a series of steps to a conclusion. And in modern philosophy, in modern semantics, they have no idea that something quite different takes place and conditions the arguments of people. He says here, a like tone or sound catches and moves another. This means to say that if we sound two totally different letters of the alphabet, which would not be associated by their difference of form, but we sound them in the same tone, they become linked by the tone, regardless of their different form. And also, if we say the same letter twice in two different tones, so the similarity or identity of the repeated letter, we tie together two different tones. Now this is actually going on in the mind all the time. Instead of the superficially conceived rational association of ideas according to defined significances of individuals, something else is going on, far more subtle. All the letters in all the words you know, which are identical, associate all those words together regardless of their reference value to the individual. And all the words that have ever been said in a given tone springing out of a given mood have also been linked together in the mind, irrespective of their alphabetic form or their reference value. This means in effect that the mind is linked together by moods, which determine tones, quite irrationally from the point of view of the individual, and that these mood linkages cut straight across the logical relations of ideas and produce relations that are quite illogical. That is, illogical from the point of view of the defined purpose of the individual. These relations are the grounds of neurotic states, psychotic states, of obsessional states, where people suddenly find words occurring in their mind irrationally, that is, not related rationally to their conscious individual purpose. And yet words keep coming together. They come together because they had a like tone from a like mood, or from the fact of the like form of the letters of the alphabet. And here he is giving, in his day, what in effect is the real ground of the association experiences at very deep levels of the psyche. He says, in that sound the spirit imprints its own similitude. Now if the spirit has a similitude, it follows that the spirit is form, and the PR in spirit means form. This S belongs to that serpent image where the absolute was considered as dynamic to be in the form of an undulating serpent. But that serpent, through its propagation and waveforms, infinitely, produces intersection points, and that is P. And on those points, the motion vibrates and radiates, and that is R. And the radiating forces crossing other radiating forces, say T. So spirit implies this absolute dynamic undulation, propagating itself infinitely, and this infinite undulating, crossing motion, producing points at the intersection places, and these themselves, in the mutual interference of the two crossing forces, producing radiating forces, and these radiating forces crossing each other, producing T's or establishments formally, all this is contained in the word spirit. And the spirit, therefore, is a formulating sentient power. Every spirit seeks a body means that the spirit itself is in its dynamic undulations and infoldings, involvings, producing spontaneously zones of interference, zones of relative opacity, which we call bodies. And the form is identical with the mode of action of the spirit in that place. Therefore, the spirit imprints its own similitude. He says, which it has conceived in the essence. And this essence is this absolute itself, considered as the source of issuance of all these appearing forms. It is brought to form in the principle. We could say, here we can interpret principle as first head of a series again, and therefore we have three principles in the body: the head of the series of ideas, the very concept of idea or form itself, which breaks on analysis into all the different geometrical shapes we know, and then the principle of feeling, I like it and I don't like it, and then the principle of purpose or prime urge directed towards being. Are we going to slow? So he says, so that in the word may be understood in what the spirit has conceived, either in good or evil. He said, by the form of the word, if you analyze it, you will be able to discover whether the spirit at the back of it, that is the sentient, generative energy which made that word, is good or evil, simply by examining the form of the word. The whole of his doctrine, and of the doctrine of signatures, and of the nature language, of the pre-Babel language, depends upon this statement, that by examining the form of the word, we can discover whether the driving force that precipitated that word is good or evil. Evil, we'll discover, is that which is contrary to life, and that which isolates, puts individuals into themselves, and cuts off all relations with other individuals. Because life itself is a relation. And even if an entity exists, if we cut off this entity from all other entities and all dynamic interrelations of constituent forces, then it is dead and is an evil. So we could then proceed to analyze words in terms of whether they further our life or decrease it. If it furthers our life, we will say that the spirit that generated that word is a good one, and if it's against our life, we will say the spirit that generated it is a bad one, an evil one. And with this signature, he enters into another man's form and awakens also in the other such a form in the signature, so that both forms mutually assimilate together in one form, and then there is one comprehension, one will, one spirit, and one understanding. Some of our top line politicians would think about that. If they really wanted one understanding, one spirit, one will, one comprehension, they could get it by willing it. And the way they would do it would be to discover the similitude in the participants in the discussion, bring the similitude to the top, where they could both see it. In other words, put their cards on the table, face up, so that both sides could see it. And providing they were really doing that, then they would have one will, one comprehension, one understanding. Now, the fact that we find in discussions, particularly between big men in the power field, not a putting of cards on the table, and not a replying to questions in the form the question requires, but a diversion, something like the one that Khrushchev did every time he was asked a question which could have been replied to with yes or no, he raised something quite different, a historical problem of the past, and used it as a diversion, because he had no will to come to an agreement. Now, this fundamental will is the same as the spirit, and this will is precipitating the argument. And if the will of that person is not to agree, then no amount of work by another will can make it agree. So that great man said, even if two men, only two men, come together, if they come together without the will to agree, then they won't agree. We find Vermin with this very clearly in his mind, that if you wish to communicate with other beings, you state clearly whether you want them to think about ideas, or to discover whether they like or dislike, or to say what is their basic direction, what it is they are trying to bring to be. If you say that, push your own statements forward, and if they do the same with you, then you must come to one will, one comprehension, and one understanding. There can be no further ground of disagreement. So where there is a ground of disagreement, it can only be in the will. Now it's because of this fact that it can only be in the will that we find in religion the statement that there exist beings whose fundamental will is to put themselves out of relation with other beings. They do so in order to be able to manipulate the other beings as things, as means to an end. There are two kinds of beings disguised as human. One of them is the being who strives always to cut off the relation so that he can pursue his own private purpose. And the other one is the being who doesn't like private purpose and is trying to increase communication in order to establish relation, because he believes that relation is more lively, more beneficial, fuller than absence of relation. Now, I won't go any further than that at the moment. Have you anything at all to say about reading in a slow manner like this? We've read two paragraphs.
One thing to me that occurs to me is you couldn't get that sort of stuff out of the dictionary, could you?
Oh yes. But it's hard work. It's hard work. I don't say you can get it out of Blackie's High Road Dictionary for Schools, although there is some good elementary etymology in that. You can get it if you have the energy to chase the things to their roots. If instead of stopping with an English modern dictionary like the single volume Oxford, which gives you a contemporary significance and makes little attempt to trace it back, then you're not really doing the work. And if you chase that word back to its root in whatever language, you will discover what it meant to the ancients who used it, and you can then discover the steps whereby it received its present current significance. And in doing so, you are discovering the methods whereby some men have duped some other men by falsifying terms. So if you take that fact of sig, if you try to chase signature, you'll come back to this Greek sig, sigma. Once we get the word stigma, that was a mark, like the mark of Cain. And it was a letter that they didn't like, so they threw it out of the alphabet. They didn't like it because it had to do with this primary sin of separate aim. In the same way they threw out, in certain parts of Greece, they threw out the letter Q because of its sexual reference. It upset them, so they threw out copper and used kappa only. So when they come up against a concept and they don't like the significance, they throw it away. And this is what we mustn't do if we are to pray properly. In the act of prayer, we take all that is, look at it, and affirm it. So we can't have a misunderstanding. Say, like a young minister with the best of intentions might get through and find himself ordained, and then find he's got a congregation of people perhaps 30 years older than himself, how can he possibly understand their motives unless he first understands his own? And how can the perception of his motives, so young, reveal to him their ancient motives unless fundamentally they haven't changed? If he examines himself and discovers that he's just as big a villain now as he was when he was two, you might find that some of the older members of the congregation haven't moved from his position either. And if he knows underneath that all his thinking is a mode of devising means whereby he can fulfill his will, then he'll begin to comprehend the people, even if they are considerably older than himself. Because he will see that you can't move from these primary fundamental facts. It doesn't matter how old you are, you've either got an idea or a feeling or a motive, or you're less than human. And if you have, it won't be very different from that of a child. Because fundamentally it is the will to satisfy itself, to fulfill its likings, avoid its dislikings, and to rationalize its mode of getting there.
I think when you speak to these people that are willing to cut off, and those that are willing to communicate, there are only those two directions, but aren't the others.
There are others.
And both, I take it, are attempting to cut off.
You have to be very careful about this. Let's consider very carefully the dialectics of cutting off. When a power man, a man who likes wielding power over others, wants to cut himself off, he only wants to cut himself off from a portion of himself, namely the part that would feel compassion from the people he intends to treat as means. But he doesn't want to cut himself off absolutely from them, because if he does, he can't utilize them. So he has a self-contradiction. There's something in him that wants to remain in contact with the people he wants to separate himself from. And simultaneously, the people who want to increase relation, there is a dialectical presence, a principle that says you cannot disappear in the relation. It's still you relating, still you trying to agree. So these two things that are opposite really not in their dialectical content, but in the stress placed upon it. As the Tao Te Ching says, it is as hard to stand out from the crowd as it is to get lost in it. It is as hard to get lost in the crowd as it is to stand out from it. If you try to merge with the crowd, and you're like this, merging as hard as you can, the people next to you say, what do you mean by merging, my friend? If you try to stand out, they'll immediately detect that you're standing on your tiptoes and pull you down. And this is because of the dialectical nature of being. The value in life is that derived from functional relations, which enhance formal presentation in consciousness. Consciousness is enriched by formal presentation. It is therefore enriched by increased relation. To get this enriched consciousness, you must relate. But the reason for relating is always to enrich your consciousness. On the other hand, if you try to enrich your consciousness and cut off the relation, you are decreasing the very thing you are trying to increase. When Christ says, if you try to preserve your life, you will lose it, he means if you isolate yourself, you are losing relation. And relation is an essential part of the development of your life. In relation, there is an exchange of energies. People in relation, functionally, in their urges, their affections, their reasons, are living at a higher level than people in isolation. So if you try to preserve your life by complete isolation, all you do is die. On the other hand, if in the pursuit of an enriched life you rush into all relations, the logical end of it would be that you would have no life of your own. You'd be absorbed in the lives of other people. But that is impossible, any more than the man who tries to isolate himself.
I was going to ask what would you describe as complete isolation? Because, say, when you take, for instance, that woman that was incarcerated for a number of years, in a way she had a greater experience than the average person that's popping about, but the consciousness function, I should have thought.
Yes, well, that's what the existentialists are talking about. A thing like absolute isolation is an abstract idea. No existent being can possibly experience it. In the same way, the absolute giving of yourself away to other people so that there's nothing left is also directly impossible. These extremes cannot be fulfilled. They're abstract terms. What can be fulfilled is that the full value of relation can be gained by an individual, providing he relates himself to the full extent of his energies and yet retains reflexively the lessons of the relations. He needs a certain amount of energy going out into other people to produce a stimulus back onto himself, and he needs to work on himself so that he can give something to other people in the relation. So there's a continuous reciprocal flow of energies. If he tries to do either, he will discover he's doing the opposite. Because Christ said, if you try to gain your life, you will lose it. But if you try to lose it, you will find it. Because you discover you can't give it away. Take your very best and most secret idea. Try to explain it to other people, to the best of your ability. See if in the very act of explaining your idea you've really communicated it, or whether you haven't communicated something different, an approximation, which leaves you with more work to do.
How do I know what is my most secret idea?
Well, you have to stop hiding from yourself in order to discover it. Your most secret idea is your most sacred idea. Secret and sacred are the same word. What is that in you which you don't want other beings to touch? That's your most sacred idea. You can define it if you think very, very carefully. What wouldn't I like people to get their hands on in me? What wouldn't I like their minds to probe into in me? And when you found that thing, that's your most sacred idea, your most secret idea. Then try to give it away. See if you can do it without boring somebody still. This is one of the things about guilt in psychiatric treatment. Very, very often a person is full of guilt. You penetrate to their guilt. What are they being guilty about? They won't tell you. It's a secret. It's too terrible. After a lot of work, you finally discover the thing that they're feeling guilty about. It's that the real reason they don't want to know about it is it's so little. It's so insignificant. It's much better to put that thing in the dark and let it in the dark, lose its edges, lose its clarity, and thus seem big and big and big, because then you have a sense of power. But supposing your secret idea is a very, very simple one. Namely, that you feel so very, very tiny that you dare not let anybody know that you're that small. You're as small as a grain of mustard seed. And the mustard hasn't operated in you. You've not yet grown so all the birds of the air can come and rest in you. That's really the secret idea that nobody wants touching inside them. They feel like a little potential of what they might become. But they haven't become it yet. They're just a potential. And they don't want anybody to touch that potential because it might stop it becoming actual. Now that's the secret idea inside everybody. That they have untold potential. And if you put your finger on it, they might wither.
Well, who has the four of us,
sir? More popular.
I don't know, GBT is it?
I'm known in one place. And in the case of Skeet's dictionary, Skeet being a clergyman, whenever a word had what we might call unmentionable roots, he just calmly said etymology underneath it. Because he doesn't like to think about such rude things. Rude means back to the root, and at the root is power. Just power, pushing things about. And if people get to the root of events, they'll realize that people are trying to push them about in a primitive manner. And they use every weapon they can get. Fantastic rituals of the mind. Foggings of the liking and disliking process. You see? And the definite taboo on the primitive areas, because that's the thing they're knocking with. That's why that has gotten to disappear. And why the people in power have condemned this. Whilst in jolly good Zen Judo, this is the center of consciousness, because it's from here that you get the real blow power. Belly power, they can't call it. It's the principle of unity. This is the principle of plurality. This partakes of this and this. So it's duality, with one side plural and the other side unity. And the whole of the taboo on this by religions, but not by religious founders, and by organized religions, is simply because this thing has no regard whatever for any fabrication of the mind that cuts across its purpose, because it knows that the fabrication of the minds of other men are merely fabrications made by their will to fulfill their purpose, by blaming them with reason. Say Shakespeare, as you like it, makes fun of the ladies and he says, "Come, lay me with reasons."
Conceived in the essence. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, that's a cutting process together. The thing is seen in this sentient substance. It is seen.
Unformulated.
Oh no, it is seen. When we do all these wiggles, you can focus your eyes, I can do it on the curtains. Mm. I can deliberately look for something that might look like a face. You see?
Yes.
Now, I'm seeing it, and I see certain elements of the pattern of the curtain together. That's consuming. And then I get a pair of scissors and cut them out.
That is
formulated.
That is
taking it through the principle, yes, into form. Yes. The fact is, the essence of it is always in sentiency, and right at the back of it is what is signified when it says, "And God loved the world, therefore." He loved the world, therefore. But this love is simply a working power to develop potentials into actuality. And one man, in a pursuit of his expression, with his eyes wide open, may detect that another man's expression over there might cut across his marking. So he sends him a message saying, "I hear from a secret source that the government have decided to put a tax on that commodity next week." If this trick stops him, on the first time I've succeeded.
You spoke about tone thinking words and letters thinking words.
Yes.
So,
oh, yeah.
All the same letter in different words, mix them all together in your mind.
Yes.
And when you say the same tone in each word, how do you mean?
Well, say the tone used by Vera Lynn has linked together in the minds of many lads in the forces during the war a whole series of words that would never have been linked, factually. You know, the popular songs get remembered.
Oh, yes.
Quite mechanically, in their form, but the rhythm and the emotional tone of it has tied them together. So you get a whole block of songs, somebody mentions one, and immediately a dozen others come up. And actually these things, put into the mind rhythmically and emotionally, retained by torch singers and others, have a peculiar effect on the life pattern of the person with them, which you can observe very amusingly by noticing that when people are thinking throughout the day, every now and then they'll start humming a tune. Now if you catch the tune that they are humming, you've got an indication of the dominant idea in their mind. And if you're in the habit of humming to yourself, if you watch the tune that occurs to you and immediately say, what was the context in which this tune was engrammed on me at its most emotionally intense, you will discover that you had a thought process which triggered off this tune, and that this tune was triggering off the associations that made the thought process.
Would that account for you having a tune that irritated you in the extreme?
Really, yes.
So much as though one part is doing something that another part quite clearly disapproves of.
Yes. I've watched fellows who were suddenly made aware of the tune they were singing and blush. Just by simply making you are singing such a tune. And that was popular in 1943. And a deep blush is spread over the face. Because they know what triggered it off. And because of the rhythm and the tone associations in music, there is more power in the mnemic field in song than there is in the unsung prose. There is more power in poetry than there is in prose. There is more power in a song, a poem sung, than there is in a poem said, because of its tone, emotive association. So if you wanted to commit to memory a string of irregular verbs or something, and you laid them out and sang them, you'd find that you could commit them to memory better that way than by slave prose exercise.
Hence the songs on TV.
On the advertising side, yes. No, it slips underneath.
In that word association exercise, do you not appear to get, at least at the beginning, the rational associations? You know, you say, oh, love, ah, me.
Yes.
Is there a stage where you start getting these tone associations?
Oh, yes, yes. The other one is simply the product of the line of least resistance, because most of your thinking has been done by a pseudo-rational form.
Yes.
But underneath it, there's been a motive that you never dared know about, because it would be frowned upon.
Yes.
If you examine how often you've done a good turn that wasn't, you can do what the mystics have experienced, begin to think you're the worst man in the world. You never had a decent motive ever. See? So you'll find the author of this book, and St. Paul. And many mystics, and they all say, with coarse legatism, I am the worst man in the world. Segatism, again, they're not. They're no more evil than that newborn baby girl. And you couldn't be worse than that. The fact is that every human being has in it exactly the same as every other human being. It is only stressed differently. And whether they cheat you on Tuesday and forgive you on Wednesday, or forgive you on Tuesday and cheat you on Wednesday, is a matter of stress. That's all, but they'll do both on Thursday and Friday.
And still sometimes you can accept that fact completely, and then you're only part of it.
That's right, and you're not praying properly.
You've
been praying out. Yeah. Didn't accidental that relation between prayer and praying, you know? If you see it evolving, you'd be surprised. That's why the praying mantis is so called. And then that lovely little insect sits up with its hand like this. Yeah. It's called the praying mantis, which is of course a praying preacher, really. He goes like this, keeps his hand going, and it sees a little fly going. And so called because of the observed behaviour of praying gentlemen.
It's a vicious insect, isn't it? Praying mantis.
Huh? Well, a girl I know had one as a pet with Israel for quite a long time. She found a village. They never did this to her. Like a woman watching the Venus flytrap on TV last night in clothes. On a flight, oh, isn't it pretty? The mere thought of going like this. It's delightful.
Did you see the diplomat who was interviewed afterwards? The most relaxed gentleman who'd been interviewed. Did you watch it?
Well, I must retire.